From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. A 72-hour ceasefire in Gaza appeared to have taken hold, with no reports of hostilities at press time some 15 hours in. Both sides traded last-minute attacks. We begin our Gaza coverage with this report from Press TV's Marzi Hashemi.
Last-minute provocation was initiated by the Israeli military, which conducted aerial strikes on several targets in northern Gaza. This drew an immediate response from the Palestinian resistance, which sent a barrage of rockets to several Israeli cities. There have been no reports of casualties on either side. Israel says it has completed its main mission of destroying cross-border tunnels in Gaza. It also says that it has already started to withdraw all ground forces from Gaza, adding that the troops will be deployed in positions outside of Gaza during the three-day ceasefire. An earlier truce scheme between Israel and Hamas fell apart only 2 hours after it took effect this past Friday.
One major difference between this ceasefire and the previous attempts is the withdrawal of Israeli troops. CPR's Bernard White spoke with Phyllis Bennis of the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. about the ceasefire and its prospects.
The significance of it, I think, was that this time Israel agreed that it would include pulling out its ground troops from Gaza. One of the main stumbling blocks in the earlier ceasefire efforts was that Israel made the claim that was not sufficiently challenged by the international community to say that there could be a ceasefire, but they were going to keep their troops in place inside the Gaza Strip, going after the tunnels, et cetera, essentially continuing the military attacks, and with the expectation only that on the Palestinian side that resistance would be ended and that they would stop the airstrikes, but that their ground attacks could continue. So, of course, it didn't work. This time it may work because it does seem to be accompanied by an almost finished move to pull Israeli troops out of the territory of Gaza, even though they were simultaneously being redeployed surrounding Gaza very closely.
You know, it just reminds me, and I don't know whether this is a good analogy, but I know that Malcolm X had one metaphor that he used to talk about progress. And if you stick a knife in my back 6 inches and you pull it out 3, do we really have progress?
Yeah, I mean, it's a real question whether this is going to work. The fundamental question is whether it will be accompanied by a serious move to open the crossings, to let Gaza breathe. If it doesn't, if it's like the ceasefire of November 2012, which Hillary Clinton negotiated, which included a specific requirement that the implementation of opening the crossings into Gaza, letting people come and go, letting goods come and go, rebuilding the economy, et cetera, that the implementation of that was supposed to begin within 24 hours of the ceasefire, never happened. And so a year and a half later, it's not so surprising that violence erupted again, because as long as people are being held essentially as prisoners in Gaza, which is the conditions that we face right now, no temporary ceasefire is going to last very long.
Mm-hmm. There's an article that appears in today's New York Times says Gaza war strains relations between U.S. and Israel. And right. I'm just wondering whether the Israelis are really interested in what kind of pressure can the United States apply to Israel?
There's a huge amount of pressure the U.S. could apply to Israel. The more relevant question, I think, is what kind of pressure is the U.S. prepared to apply against Israel? And that's where we have trouble. I think most listeners will be aware that the U.S. provides, as a starting point, $3.1 billion in direct military aid to Israel every year. It's the only country that's allowed to spend a big chunk of that military aid on their own military-industrial complex, if you will, rather than having to buy everything from U.S. war profiteers. It's also the only country that gets their entire aid budget at the beginning of the year, which means they earn millions in interest that no other country does. And crucially, the U.S. also provides absolute impunity for Israel and Israeli officials, military and political, preventing them from ever being held accountable for their potential war crimes in the United Nations, in the International Criminal Court, etc. And while Israel could function fine politically, militarily, and economically without the U.S. aid, it is, after all, either the 23rd or 26th wealthiest country in the world, depending on whether you believe the CIA or the IMF, it's a very wealthy country. It doesn't need the aid. What it does need is the protection. If the U.S. made clear that it was going to impose an arms embargo, which it is required to do, actually, under U.S. law that prohibits selling arms to any country that has shown to have a pattern and practice of human rights violations, which even the State Department's own annual reports indicate that. If it was going to impose an arms embargo and it was going to stop providing the kind of protection that it does in the United Nations, then we would be seeing some serious possibilities of shifts in Israeli practice. As long as we have the situation we do now, where even with increasingly critical statements coming from President Obama, from Secretary of State Kerry, etc., as long as those statements are matched in the most egregious cases within hours of the announcement that there will be $225 million additional, $250 million more added to the grant this year to pay for more of the so-called Iron Dome military system, the defense system in Israel, and that the U.S. will open up its giant arms and ammunition warehouse that it uses, it keeps in Israel, supposedly to provide military equipment for the United States if it ever needs them, says, we're going to open up the candy store, kids, go and help yourselves. As long as those actions accompany the statements, I don't think anyone in Israel is going to worry too much about the statements.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're led to believe, based on the articles, the way the articles are written, in today's times, that Hamas had rejected Egypt's first attempt to broker a peace, and now they've come back and are willing to accept the previous proposal. Do you think
I think one of the big differences between that early proposal and this one, there's two big differences. One is in the first round, they weren't consulted. The Palestinians were not even brought into the discussions about what the ceasefire would be based on. They were discussions between Israel and Egypt, with the U.S. overseeing it, which meant it was all one side negotiating with each other, essentially. Because under the military government that now rules in Cairo, Israel and Egypt are very close allies, to the detriment of the Palestinians. So no Palestinian representation was there. Secondly, that initial proposal did not call for Israel to withdraw its ground troops. This one does, so that's significantly different. This time, negotiations did involve the Palestinians and Qatar, which has close ties with Hamas, and they were involved with the negotiations with Egypt. So it's a different set of players, and it's a different substance that's emerged as the basis of the ceasefire.
I want you to look into your crystal ball and tell me, do you think that this is going to hold?
I think this one has a good chance of holding for 72 hours. I think the question of whether it lasts and whether it means very much beyond 72 hours respite for the beleaguered population of Gaza, time to dig out more of their dead, time to stock up on medicines in the hospitals, etc., if it's going to have a chance for more than that, we will know that on the basis of how seriously these discussions can go further in those 3 days about opening the crossings. Mm-hmm. That's the fundamental question. If the expectation is, as the Israelis like to put it, that we will have quiet for quiet, the Palestinians that will be quiet will be those that are dead. that have already been killed by this. If they are not allowed to breathe, there is no way that there is going to be, quote, quiet. As long as the Israeli troops are surrounding Gaza, Gaza remains encircled by a wall. The airspace is controlled by the Israeli Air Force. The waters are controlled by the Israeli Navy, allowing the fishermen to go out only 3 kilometers instead of the 30 kilometers that they're guaranteed by the Oslo Accords. As long as these violations continue, the notion that there will be quiet for quiet simply doesn't fly. So there's going to have to be some modicum of justice. Even if it doesn't mean lifting the embargo altogether, there's got to be an opening of the crossings to allow Gaza to breathe.
Meanwhile, the UN's World Food Program was preparing to try to alleviate the desperate food shortages in Gaza. The WFP has already reached more than 318,000 conflict-affected people in Gaza with emergency food assistance. Patrick Maigwa spoke with WFP's Elizabeth Byers about increasing the delivery of emergency food to civilians.
WFP have begun a large-scale effort to bring fresh bread and ready-to-eat ration to people in Gaza. We have distributed emergency food ration, food vouchers to over 318,000 people in Gaza. And we work closely with UNRWA to bring also fresh bread to the people in shelters. We aim to bring 10 tons of bread from Jerusalem to Gaza each day. This is a fact that will relieve the significant pressure on Gaza bakeries who have power outages.
And how is the fighting inside Gaza affecting your operations?
The logistic operation are active and we are able to bring supplies to Gaza. But there are significant constraints within Gaza in bringing food to distribution location due to security condition. It's a fact. But with this logistic cluster, which is now active, and WFP is in charge of the whole logistic operation for UN and NGO, the first convoy is scheduled to enter Gaza today. And this convoy has already crossed yesterday the border crossing of Kerem Shalom with canned meat, milk, biscuits, wheat flour, fresh bread produced in Jerusalem. So we hope to be able to distribute this food today.
There are very many people who are sheltering in UN facilities. There are many others who have not been able to reach any of these shelters. How are you able to reach those who are still displaced out there in Gaza?
We are reaching many people, and in shelter, WFP assists approximately 270,000 displaced people in 95 UNRWA shelters with emergency food ration. But the number of displaced people continues to increase in shelter, and this is a concern. We also provide emergency food ration to public school shelters to approximately over 15,000 displaced people in 19 other public shelters. We also distribute an electronic vouchers as well for families sheltering in those communities. And this represents approximately 14,000 people who have been reached with vouchers. It's an increase of more than 1,700 families since 31st of July. In Gaza, WFP has 60 voucher shops, but 25 shops are closed, and they were closed due to security condition or damage. So we are working very hard to add additional voucher shops to our program.
And how would you describe the conditions under which your staff are working in Gaza?
The security conditions are of concern, of course, And we work, of course, very closely with the UN Relief and Works Agency and other group in Gaza. It's a difficult condition. We are doing our best to reach people. We are bringing additional ready-to-eat food because people cannot cook because of the lack of fuel and electricity. And despite security condition and damage to mills, to bakeries, WFP is doing its best to scale up its operation and to reach more and more people. But the security conditions are, of course, of concern and are worrying because the escalation in Gaza comes at a time of increased vulnerability and also 40,000 people working for the authorities did not receive their salary for May and June. So this is an additional factor of vulnerability. And we can say that there are 50% of people food insecure in the Gaza Strip.
And the humanitarian situation in East Ukraine has also deteriorated rapidly, with several cities facing crisis-level humanitarian conditions. The city of Lugansk declared a state of humanitarian catastrophe due to a lack of electricity, medical supplies, water and sewer, and mobile and internet communications. Some 250,000 civilians are unable to leave, and heavy shelling by the Ukrainian government forces has destroyed most of the sanitation and other municipal service vehicles, leaving the city without garbage collection for several weeks in the summer. Similar conditions affect other cities that have been under siege by the U.S.-backed Kiev forces. The number of internally displaced people in Ukraine has reached at least 117,000, the Office of the UN High Commissioner for Refugees in Geneva said Tuesday. It also said that 168,000 people have fled to Russia. Most people who left their homes but remained in Ukraine are from the country's eastern Lugansk and Donetsk regions, some 103,000 people, according to UN estimates. Meanwhile, the UN issued a statement that the investigation and recovery effort at the site where the Malaysia Airlines passenger flight crashed remains blocked because of continued shelling in the area. The OCSE spokesperson, Michael Bachierkov, told journalist Elena Vopnichnaya that, for now, the focus is on recovering the victims' remains and personal belongings only.
Their investigation and the recovery effort has been hampered, especially yesterday, by shelling, nearby shelling in the area. And, of course, we view this as unacceptable because there is meant to be a ceasefire, kind of tailor-made ceasefire for this work to be able to proceed. But that was violated yesterday. We don't know by which side. But, you know, time is of the essence right now. So we're hopeful that it will remain calm and, you know, the experts can go about their work.
We'll have more on this when we bring you part two of our report from Patrick Lancaster on the ground in Donetsk later in this program. A man dressed in an Afghan army uniform opened fire Tuesday on troops at a military base, killing a U.S. general and wounding several others. NATO was investigating the incident involving both Afghan and international troops at Camp Karga, a base west of the capital Kabul, which trains officers for the Kabul government's army. Japan's military appears to be integrating the remilitarization policies of the Abe government that would reinterpret the prohibition in Japan's constitution against, quote, land, sea, and air forces, as well as other war potential, closed quote. The reinterpretation would allow such forces. The Japanese Defense Ministry said in its annual report that the decision by the country's cabinet on defense policy changes has had historic significance. The report presented by the Defense Ministry at a cabinet meeting Tuesday said the security situation around Japan has become increasingly severe with, quote, various challenges and destabilizing factors becoming more tangible and acute, closed quote. The report named China and North Korea as potential threats. Did Edward Snowden start a trend of whistleblowing in the U.S. intelligence community? The U.S. government has apparently concluded that there is a new post-Snowden leaker who has been supplying members of the media with classified documents. We will be following this story as it develops. We now bring you part two of that interview with American journalist Patrick Lancaster on the ground in Donetsk in eastern Ukraine.
Ukrainian jets started flying overhead and bombing Toraz and Shakhtars, which are very close to the the wreck site.
Right.
And then we realized that we were kind of in a interesting, dangerous situation.
Yeah, no kidding.
We were basically between the different towns that were where there were heavy clashes going on. Mm. And we had to try to figure out how to drive around those areas and kind of get close, but not too close, and get kind of out and away from the danger. But every little road that we went down, there were tank tracks, and the locals were telling us how we're seeing Ukrainian tanks and Donetsk forces tanks. Mm-hmm. You know, and as we drove through the outskirts of Shakhtarsk, we were driving down the highway, driving into the sun, and there was a point when our taxi driver couldn't see in front of us a bit, and at that, because of the sun, the glare from the sun, at that point, seven Donetsk People's Republic soldiers jumped out in front of us, or they were there and we just couldn't see them. I'm not sure exactly what happened because the sun was bright in our eyes. But they had Kalashnikovs held to us, and two of them had rocket-propelled grenades. I mean, I don't know exactly what they'd do with those in such close proximity, but it was kind of a scary situation. But we skidded to a stop with the Kalashnikovs to our heads, and once they realized that we were pressed, they were okay with us. They just said, we need to go the other way.
Right.
And we picked up there was a woman crying on the side of the road, and we picked her up and took her out of the town to a safer town down the way. But it was definitely a very mind-opening day, because that day showed me how, you know, this war is really complicated and really horrible, because it's not just one side that's doing wrong. The Ukrainian government is, you know, killing civilians on a daily basis, but also some parts of the Donetsk People's Republic forces are not doing the correct thing. We traveled through this small village, and there wasn't actually active fighting going on. As we looked in front of us in the center, we saw a group of vehicles and people, and as we got closer, we realized it was a platoon of Donetsk People's Republic soldiers. It was somewhere between 50 and 100, and there was two tanks, two large anti-aircraft guns, and it seemed that they were taking refuge in the very center of this small town.
Right.
And, I mean, my first thought of that was how very irresponsible that is, because there was so many towns around getting sieged by the Ukrainian army. Why would they be hiding in the middle of a populated area?
You know, I don't know about that, but on the other hand, I mean, with these, I understand that there's certainly some professionals involved and people that have either served in the Ukrainian military or what, the old Soviet military, even for some of the older people involved. But I'm thinking about if there were an analogous situation where I am in New York, outside New York City. That if for some reason suddenly, you know, the people had to arm themselves and fight the government, you know, I'd be scared of some of the characters that would be on my side, knowing them just as neighbors, okay? And, you know, suddenly they're armed with a Kalashnikov or whatever, and they didn't handle pruning shears very well without starting neighborhood wars and things like that. So it's not, I don't know if they would necessarily have the same military discipline among the troops there, you know, at the individual level and then at the platoon level, even, as you would expect from a professional military. So I don't know if you know, but wars, the idea of war itself is immoral. So in terms of morality, it's already an even fight. But I don't know if I would hold a militia or a group, a military grouping in a revolutionary condition to the same standard as the professional military is supposed to be. myself. That's just me. I don't know. I mean,
yes, but yeah. At the same time, there should be steps taken to reduce the possibility of non-combatant life being lost.
Yep, it's true.
I mean, I haven't seen the Donetsk People's Republic. I haven't seen this with my own eyes so many times. But there are times when they fire mortars from populated areas, and they have equipment in populated areas. So I think when they do that, that is, you know, a bit
irresponsible,
frankly. Irresponsible,
yeah.
And against international law. Mm. But I mean, this is a very nasty war, and people, like you say, they kind of have to do what they have to do to survive. But it's just shows how much of a tricky situation this is.
I'm just saying, go back wherever you live, go back to your neighborhood, wherever you grew up, where you knew everybody. You know, if you had a place like that, and think about some of the people who, just because they live on the block, would be in your unit. And think about walking around with them armed with a gun or a mortar device or whatever, and how comfortable you'd be with some of them, you know. It's not a professional military situation. It's just a bunch of guys with weapons, which is scary. Anyway, so let me just be clear on something. So you were an eyewitness to the Ukrainian military bombing firing from fighter jets on the areas around the airplane crash site, where the inspectors were supposed to be able to have safe conduct and safe operations. Is that a true statement?
Yes. I mean, there were jets flying overhead, and there were explosions happening in the towns. I was on an overlook, and I could see the jets flying, mm-hmm. and I could see huge plumes of smoke coming from three different villages, Torres, Shaktorsk, and a smaller village. And there were different jets flying, and there was much gunfire, and I could also hear anti-aircraft weaponry being fired.
So the characterization here in the media has been that the inspectors couldn't get to the site because of the Donetsk People's Republic units or irregulars or whatever. In other words, the rebels are preventing the inspectors from doing their job. Is that an inaccurate statement?
Right now, I think that's an inaccurate statement. I believe the fighting in the conflict was keeping them from getting to the crash sites, as far as in the last days. The first 2 days of after the crash, there was some problems in the Donetsk People's Republic forces that were at the crash site, because I think they just weren't sure how to handle it when the OSCE observers showed up. Right. So for the first 2 days, there was some resistance by the Donetsk forces there as far as giving them proper access. But I was there the first day, the first time they were given the proper access on the Sunday after the accident, 3 days after the crash. And at that point, it seemed like the orders had made its way down the chain of command, and the OSCE forces were given very proper bodyguards. In my position, my opinion, the soldiers that were given to them seemed much more professional than the normal ones that had been at the crash site before. Right. They did a very made a very strict perimeter of the areas that the OSCE observers were inspecting at each given time. It seemed it was going very, very well for them getting access to the sites. But in the following days after the fighting started, then that's when the lack of access happened to the crash site as far as the OSCE observers go. And that was because of the fighting.
And we'll bring you more of that interview with Patrick Lancaster in Donetsk tomorrow. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.